From CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. A $54 billion budget deficit for the state of California. That's the projection released about an hour ago by the California Finance Department. On the phone is H.D. Palmer, Deputy Director for External Affairs with the department. And H.D., thanks for joining us today.
Morning, Beth.
So give me some of your reaction when you and others at the department realized the magnitude of this projected deficit.
Well, we knew that there was going to be a substantial hit to revenues because of the unprecedented economic damage that's been caused by the COVID-19 pandemic. But when we finalized, or in the process of finalizing the size of the deficit for the May revision, it really brings it home in stark detail. $54.3 billion is a remarkable amount, not seen in any time since the Great Recession of 2009. The more troubling thing, I guess, is that we started out the year in very good fiscal shape, probably better than any other state in the country. We paid off all of our past borrowing. The wall of debt was gone. We had a $5.6 billion surplus. The governor, Governor Newsom, proposed a balanced budget not only for next year but the following 3 years. And we've reflected a record level of reserves next year of about $21 billion, of which $16 billion is socked away in the state's rainy day fund. To give you an idea of the magnitude of what we've got to deal with right now, the size of that $54 billion deficit is 3.5 times the size of the revised balance of $16 billion in that fund, which underscores two things. Number one, very difficult decisions on how to close that lie ahead. The governor will put out his proposal a week from today when he releases his May revision. The legislature is going to have to make decisions on that, too, because they have to pass a balanced budget by June the 15th. And it also underscores the critical need, in the governor's view, for further assistance by the federal government, not just for California, but for all states and for local governments, so that we don't see the kinds of very devastating impacts on core services that state and local governments are providing in such areas as public health and public safety. Governor Newsom last month wrote to Speaker Nancy Pelosi and recommended a nationwide package of $1 trillion, not just for California, but for all 50 states and for their local governments, for cities and counties, because the scope and severity of this crisis are unprecedented. Speaker Pelosi, according to news reports, is working with her colleagues in the House of Representatives on another round of pandemic relief. The $1 trillion figure has been discussed in that dialogue, and the governor looks forward to working with the speaker and other members of the California congressional delegation and other governors as well, so we can move this issue forward, we hope. Because, again, we have, in California, we've managed well. We've balanced budgets. We've built reserves. We've paid off debt. And despite that, the scope and severity of this pandemic and the economic impact is breathtaking.
From this report, H.D., it acknowledges already $1 billion allocated toward this COVID-19 crisis, but it reads, for cash flow purposes, an additional $6 billion in response-related expenditures is projected in 2020. $6 billion more. But it's possible, isn't it, that that number will be higher in this year?
That's certainly possible. We hope it's going to be lower because we hope, as Governor Newsom has said repeatedly, that Californians keep doing what they've been doing, which is following the stay-at-home guidelines, practicing social distancing, and flattening the curve. That said, our most recent estimate, and we'll update this next week, is that we project the state's going to be spending about $7 billion in calendar year 2020 for efforts to combat the virus and to prevent its spread. The good news for that is, under a federal disaster declaration, we will be receiving reimbursement from the federal government from that, at least 75 cents on the dollar. But even with that federal reimbursement, we are still looking at a remarkably large deficit that is going to require difficult decisions in order to close, which underscores the severity of the problem, number one. And number two, in the governor's view, the critical nature of Washington to work as partners with states to weather this crisis and to avoid significant reductions in core services in to citizens at the state and the local level.
In terms of where general state fund dollars go, schools get almost 35% of general fund dollars. That's the highest category. The next category down, I believe, is Medi-Cal at about 15.5%. If difficult decisions lie ahead, and that phrase is specifically used in this fiscal report, do the slices of the pie get cut proportionately? I know I'm asking you to sort of project the work of the lawmakers here right now, but with schools getting the majority of this, are the cuts to schools going to be, is that something to be anticipated in a deeper way?
Well, let's just look at, regardless of what the governor will propose next week or what the legislature will take up, let's look at how the Constitution works right now. Back in 1988, the people of California passed something called Proposition 98, which provided a constitutional funding guarantee for K-12 schools and community colleges. That level of funding rises and falls on the natural with changes in state revenues. Under that calculation right now, if nothing is done, the revenue decline would result in lower funding for K-12 schools and community colleges by more than $18 billion. Now, that said, that's just the ministerial mechanics of how the constitutional formula works. The governor is going to address how we look at that next Thursday when he puts his plan before the legislature, as well as how he proposes to deal with the other significant areas of general fund spending, and as you noted, health and human services programs, and namely Medi-Cal, are the second largest area behind K-12 education. And Medi-Cal is critical because roughly 14 million people in California, one out of every three, receive their health care through Medi-Cal. So that is going to be a challenge on how we deal with that, number one. And number two, as I was mentioning a moment ago, in order to avoid the kinds of reductions that will affect vulnerable populations, to protect our safety net programs, to do the least amount of damage in this unprecedented economic recession that we are weathering right now. That is why Governor Newsom believes it is critical for the federal government to work as partners with all 50 states, regardless of political affiliation, because this is a national problem that requires a national partnership to work through. We are going to get through this on an economic basis. There's no question about that. The governor has made it very clear that we're resilient people in California. We've got through the Great Recession in 08. We got through the dot-com collapse in 2001. We got through the 91-92 recession when the defense and aerospace industries collapsed in California. That said, we've got difficult decisions that are going to lie ahead of us to get through this. The governor will step up next Thursday and provide what he believes is a roadmap to get there. The legislature is going to have to confront those difficult decisions as well, because they have a requirement to pass a balanced budget by June the 15th.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with H.D. Palmer, Deputy Director for External Affairs with the Finance Department. We're talking about a $54.3 billion projected deficit for the state of California in this May revision forecast. H.D., I want you to listen to something that the governor said yesterday at the very end of his press conference. He had been asked by a reporter how confident he is that California can rebound from the shutdown, something you were just referring to, and in particular, he was asked how long he thinks it will take. So here's what he said.
It's going to take longer than I think a lot of people think. We've never experienced anything like this in our lifetime. This is depression era numbers in terms of the unemployment you'll see across this country, not just in the state of California. Again, please just do the math on the number of unemployed Californians that have filed just since March 12th.
So our math is about 3.6 million. It's being called 4 million Californians. Did you hear what he said? Depression era numbers. Will you respond to that?
Unfortunately, the governor's right when he said, do the math and look at the numbers. One of the things that is unique, unfortunately, about the recession that we're in right now is that compared to prior recessions, such as the Great Recession in 2009, or the dot-com collapse in 2001. That hit sectors of California's economy hard, whether it's the tech sector or whether it was in, you know, the collapse of the subprime mortgage industry. even during those recessions, people were still going to restaurants. People were still going to ball games. Tourists from California and around the world were still going to hotels and going to Disneyland and Universal and visiting San Francisco and Hollywood. That hasn't happened in this one because we've had wholesale shutdowns of economic sectors in California of an unprecedented nature. That's reflected in our forecast of 18% unemployment for the calendar year of 2020. It's also reflected in the new numbers that are out this morning from the Labor Department, right, in terms of unemployment claims. To give you an example of that, we had more than 300,000 claims filed last week, bringing the total amount of claims,
right,
since this pandemic occurred to 4 million claims in California. To put that into perspective, the entire population of the city of Sacramento is only 1.5 million people. The entire population of the city of Los Angeles is 4 million people. So to put it in some very painful perspective, we've had the number of unemployment claims that have been filed in the last 6 weeks is equal to the amount of individuals who live in the city of Los Angeles. That, in the governor's, as the governor was saying, look at the numbers and do the math, and you can understand the scope and severity of what we are painfully living through at this moment.
And it's still a sliding issue that we are in the midst of, but I want to thank you for your time today, and I'll refer people to capradio.org and throughout the day for more information. HD, I appreciate the report and the conversation today. Thanks for joining us on Insight.
Thank you, Beth.
That's H.D. Palmer. He's Deputy Director of External Affairs with the California Finance Department. This news, of course, comes in the midst of what is a patchwork of cautious and phased reopenings across the state. You probably know the Yuba Sutter Mall reopened yesterday, and that was a bit of a jump ahead of the state by county leaders. Cap Radio reporter Bob Moffitt was there. He's on the phone with us now. Hi, Bob.
Good morning.
So tell me about being at the mall. I'm sure you had a lot of company yesterday.
Yeah, it was certainly full of.
Well,
the nail salon was packed. There was a line out the door. That was a little surprising.
So let's listen to a clip, a bit of a moment from someone at the mall that you talked to.
I was just disappointed at the fact that not very many customers are wearing masks. I thought that they would take more responsibility and wear masks.
Tell me about the masks, Bob. And I know there was some concern throughout the day, and the Yuba Sutter County Health Director had to speak out about this. Give me more context.
Well, if you've been anywhere in Yuba Sutter County in the last couple of weeks, this is nothing new. And Fong Liu, the health department director for both counties, had already planned to send out a letter to businesses before the mall opened. So it wasn't directly a result of the mall opening. But, yeah, it's, you go to Home Depot or Walmart on any given Sunday, and it's busier than it was at Christmas. And by far, maybe, 80% of the people are not wearing masks. People are taking their children to the store. Sometimes you have to, and people understand that, of course. But as far as the county directive goes, which is if you have to go out in public, you need to cover your face if you cannot maintain social distancing. Well, some places you can't maintain social distancing.
Right.
So that's kind of that he was surprised that people weren't wearing masks. Well, people don't actually have to wear masks if they can maintain social distancing, but when you have people crossing paths and you have people going in different directions, it's not really, it's not like you're standing right next to somebody, but you're still not always able to maintain that 6 feet of distance. The people that work in the mall, with the exception of the one person who works at the barbershop, who said she's never worn a mask, almost all the clerks and employees were wearing masks, but the customers were not.
All right, Bob, real quickly, was there anything said about the mall being closed again if there was kind of too much risk in the public being there?
Well, and again, the county order, the county letter that went out to businesses yesterday was not it, the timing of it was the same day, but it wasn't a direct result of the mall reopening, according to the county. It was directed at all businesses, including Walmart and Home Depot, where large groups of people have gathered. And that letter fully states, if you don't control the situation, if you don't get people apart from each other and mandate masks when they can't be separate, then, yeah, we make.
Okay.
Which are.
Hey, Bob, your phone keeps going out, but I think we caught the end of the sentence, which was, yeah, we may close you down. So thanks very much. That's Cap Radio's Bob Moffitt reporting about the opening yesterday of the Yuba Sutter Mall in Yuba County. It is also National Nurses Week, and it continues with recognition, and you may have seen some of the remarkable tributes for the millions of nurses who are right now on the front lines of the COVID-19 battle or in the midst of this time that we're in. On the phone is Toby Marsh. He is Chief Nursing Officer at UC Davis Medical Center. Hi, Toby. Thanks for taking a moment to talk with us today.
Hi, Beth. How are you?
Well, I'm good. I feel so proud and grateful for all the work the nurses are doing. Can you tell me from your side about an experience that's defining this battle, maybe a moment or an image that your mind keeps going to?
You know, for me, as I walk the different nursing units throughout the hospital, it is the brave clinicians and nurses who are at the bedside with our patients, and specifically at this time with patients who are isolated for their protection and our staff's protection for COVID-19. And it's the nurses who are going into the rooms and comforting those patients, holding their hands when their family members cannot be there, and them showing up for work every day and doing what they do every single day. And that's the phenomenal care that they provide and we're proud of.
I think so often about the fact that nurses have to stand there for and on behalf of families right now. I do want to mention this Year of the Nurse blog, which is wonderful. Your story is there, but it's an opportunity to feel like there's some one-on-one connection with the people who are taking these shifts right now. So that's a cool project.
It is. And, you know, with me, I have Kelly Hamilton and Al Nutt, who both participated in our nursing story blog as part of the Year of the Nurse and Nurses Week. And one of the nice things about this story blog is so often we hear the gratitude from our patients about the care and the impact that we provide. But this nursing story blog is really our opportunity to share those intimate moments that we have with our patients and to share those with our other colleagues, but our community as well, and to see what it is that we do together and for our community, and what it means to us to be so privileged to have times to be in the lives of our patients that are so vulnerable and so intimate, and we feel so honored and privileged to share those stories with you.
That's Toby Marsh, Chief Nursing Officer at UC Davis Medical Center. We'll post a link to that Year of the Nurse blog. Al Nutt is standing by, as Toby just said. And Al, great to have you on the show. Can you share with me some of your first awareness, really, of COVID-19, the bigness of what this was doing to our community?
Yeah, thanks for having me once again, Beth. You know, I think that The real change that I've felt in the midst of this pandemic as a nurse really is just, you know, we do this on a day-to-day basis, but it really almost feels like we've been called up to the big leagues now at this point in time, that we, you know, this is why I became a nurse, was to help people when they are in the midst of a crisis and, you know, they're in the most powerless and vulnerable states and oftentimes the lowest points of their lives. And it really is, you know, inspiring and an honor to be able to be there for those people and uplift them in this time, especially when they are being isolated from, you know, visits from family members. A lot of people are, you know, scared that they will catch what they may potentially have at that point in time. And being able to be there and be that, you know, shining light in this person's life in a time of darkness is really, you know, inspiring within myself, and that this is why I do what I do.
Al Nutt is a medical intensive care unit nurse at UC Davis Medical Center. Kelly Hamilton is also a medical intensive care nurse at UC Davis. And Kelly, thanks for joining us as well. Being in that ICU is the most forward of the front line. What do you say to yourself every day as you get ready to take on another shift?
Thank you so much for that question, Beth. I think what I try to remind myself when I get ready for the shift is just to slow down, take some deep breaths, focus on the present moment, and remind myself that, you know, this is my job. We, as nurses, care for people who are critically ill, and that we have the opportunity to help that person who's critically ill feel connected with someone other than just themselves. Because like Al was saying, our patients are so isolated right now from their loved ones too. It's an honor to be able to go in there and sit with people in these really difficult times and provide them some human connection and compassion.
Well, I thank you all for your service to all of us, and much, much gratitude and many good wishes for good health. Thank you. And keep going. Keep going.
Thank you so much, Beth, for having us on your show.
That's Kelly Hamilton, Al Nutt, and Chief Nursing Officer Toby Marsh from UC Davis. We'll post a link so you can see their stories at capradio.org/insight. National Nurses Week continues, so remember to thank or think of a nurse that you know. Up next, we're going to shift to your mental health and talk a bit about anxiety. This is Insight on Cap Radio. Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. People who don't usually experience depression or anxiety might have found it surprising to feel some of those symptoms during the stay-at-home time or in the worries in general about COVID-19. Although, if you don't usually experience it, do you recognize it in yourself? And then people who already do have mental health issues have had an especially difficult time. We're going to focus a bit now on anxiety. And Andrea Peterson is joining us. She's a health reporter at the Wall Street Journal and the author of a book titled On Edge, A Journey Through Anxiety. Hi, Andrea. Glad to have you on the program.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Let me ask about each situation separately. So for the person who doesn't usually feel anxiety or depression, how might it be showing up now?
Well, I mean, this is a very uncertain time, and uncertainty is particularly anxiety-inducing. You know, many people are worried about their own health, the health of their loved ones. There's the stress of job losses and the shredding of routines and support systems that can really, you know, it can fuel anxiety in people who already have it, and induce it in people who may, you know, in normal times not struggle so much with anxiety.
When it shows up in a clear way that perhaps feels like a heart attack, but it's not. It's a panic attack or an anxiety attack. That's pretty obvious. But what are some other impacts from the experience of anxiety?
Well, there's two kind of buckets that it falls into. There's the physical symptoms. Yes, more in the most sort of extreme version is a panic attack, which is a sudden surge of symptoms that can include everything from, you know, severe shortness of breath to chest pain to feeling dizzy, and it's usually very dramatic. It comes on suddenly and it usually eases within 10 or 15 minutes, and it can feel like a medical emergency. Two, more chronic anxiety, it can come up in people who have what's called generalized anxiety disorder, which is characterized by a lot of worry. The what if, you know, trying to, you know, and that can, you can find yourself trying to answer these unanswerable questions. Will I get sick? Will my family get sick? You know, people will end up often having sleep difficulties too. That can also manifest itself as well. It can also manifest in muscle aches because you may not be realizing it, but often people who are anxious end up sort of tightening their muscles in kind of involuntarily. So there's a real constellation of symptoms. It can also show up in, like I said, in sleep disturbances as well.
So it's important to know what triggers your anxiety, what things you worry about. But we did speak to a sleep expert earlier this week that said those crazy dreams that a lot of people are experiencing. Those over time will mellow out as you get sort of desensitized to it and learn how to function. Do you think the same is true if it's not chronic anxiety for anxiety, that over time you can become accustomed and start adapting and the anxiety will mellow?
Well, what's interesting is that, you know, one of the major actually treatments for anxiety disorders, it's something called exposure therapy. And what you do is you gradually and systematically approach the very things that you're afraid of and learn how to manage any sort of anxiety symptoms that surge. So yes, sort of, you know, continuing to approach situations or face situations that make you anxious do ultimately oftentimes reduce the amount of anxiety. So yes, and we are very adaptable too. And so, and also talking to, you know, the number of people who say that they're having, that the pandemic is having a serious impact on their mental health. There was a survey released last month by the American Psychiatric Association that said that more than one third of Americans are feeling that way.
Right.
And many mental health helplines are seeing a real surge in the number of calls. But what was interesting, I was talking to one helpline who said that the nature of the calls are different. In the first couple of weeks, it was this really surging anxiety about their own health or their loved one's health. Then it sort of turned into anxiety about the economy and lost jobs, and also worry about or depression about sort of feeling isolated. And now people are seeing more kind of relationship issues as people have been sort of cooped up together for a very long time. It's causing some conflict with the people that we live with.
Yeah, these waves of experience are so interesting. You wrote about therapy sessions that are going virtual, and I think that's something to add in case people are feeling disconnected from a therapist or a doctor who might be the lifeline. It doesn't have to be that way, right?
That's right. Basically, within the course of just a couple weeks, almost all outpatient mental health treatment has migrated online. And psychologists, psychiatrists, couples counselors, people who work with young children, they've all really gotten very creative. People are doing group therapy online as well via things like Zoom for healthcare. It's a password protective, a little bit more secure version of Zoom than what maybe you were doing with happy hour with your friends. Mm-hmm. But most therapists are offering those kind of video only sessions. Also, you can do it on the phone too. And health insurers and Medicare and Medicaid have also relaxed some of the restrictions that have prevented some people from accessing this kind of teletherapy. So most people can get coverage just as they would for a in-person session. So that is something that definitely, if it's interfering with your life and it's causing a lot of problems, you know, reaching out to a therapist is a really good idea.
We'll post a link to that article and a few of your others. One last question, Andrea. How are you managing it right now? What are you saying to yourself? What are you doing to help keep yourself in a sort of balance?
One thing that's really great to do is, because most of our regular routines have been really upended, is creating a routine for yourself. You know, a time to get up, a time to go to bed, a time to do the work you need to do, and also I schedule walks with my daughter and my husband every day. I make sure that I have at least one phone call with a friend every day. So scheduling things that bring you joy are also really important.
All right. I'm going to pick up on that phrase, scheduling a walk, and move on. But Andrea, thanks so much for joining us. I really appreciate that we could talk about anxiety. It's just one of many chapters where people need to take care of themselves right now. But great information. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much for shedding light on this.
That's Andrea Peterson. She's a Wall Street Journal reporter, and her book, again, is titled On Edge, A Journey Through Anxiety. This is National Mental Health Awareness Month. It is in the midst of this transition right now in the coronavirus pandemic. On the phone is David Bain, Executive Director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, or NAMI. Hi, David. Glad to have you back on Insight.
Hi, Beth. Thanks for having me back.
I want to be sure we start with the information when I said scheduling a walk. This was going to be a big month for NAMI walks across the country, including here in Sacramento. It's been revised a little. Would you explain?
Yes, it's been a bit of an adventure. So initially here in Sacramento, we were scheduled to do the Northern California NAMI walks on May 2nd, last Saturday. And there were NAMIs throughout the United States that were going to do them all here in the spring. We decided collectively to gather together, and we rescheduled the date for May 30th. And so we now call it NAMI Walks Your Way. And people can, instead of coming to a central location to do their walkathon, they can walk at home, walk on a treadmill in their yard, they can jog, ride a bike. Some people will be doing NAMI yoga. I'll personally be doing NAMI gardening in my backyard. Anything that's kind of an activity that gets you outside, gets you active, and a way of connecting through that activity. And then we're asking people to take pictures and videos and upload them to the internet on Saturday, May 30th, as kind of that connecting throughout the United States as a national day of hope.
All right. We'll post a link to NAMI and the information about registering for the virtual walks on May 30th. Would you just add a comment about resources and guidance available during this COVID-19 time?
As Julia had mentioned, we have also gone online with our support groups. We are doing support groups for individuals who are living with a mental health condition and also for family members of those living with mental health conditions. We're out there trying to take care of caregivers as well. And so we've done that online. The Hope Cooperative here in town has online navigators that will help direct people. We have a helpline that people can call in and find out where they can get help here in the local Sacramento area.
All right, David, thank you so much for your time. Be well, and I appreciate that. There'll be a lot of fun virtually for everyone to join in.
Yes, thank you, Beth.
Okay, that's David Bain, National Alliance on Mental Illness. And again, May 30th for the virtual walks. We'll be back after a short break. The Uplift is coming up next. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. This is Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruriak. If you're looking for a way to converse with kids about COVID-19, you might want to consider a new book titled Has Anyone Seen Normal? This is a coronavirus tale by Ace and Lacey Stryker. The family lives in El Dorado Hills outside of Sacramento. They're on the phone, and their book is our uplift today. Hi, Ace. Hi, Lacey.
Hi, how are you?
Thank you for having us.
Glad to have you both on. So, Lacey, in your story, a young girl's world is upside down because Normal is missing. They don't know where he's gone.
And yes, exactly.
This is a story we all know something about. So how's it been for your family during this time?
I think we're settling in fairly well. We still have what I would call emotional outbursts that seem outrageous, but we're trying to have a little more compassion for those because we all are experiencing them. But so, the first few weeks were, you know, kind of touch and go. Everyone kept wondering when they're going to school. Why can't we go to those playgrounds? Why can't we go to the library? But they're kind of just settling into this is the way it is for now.
Ace, tell the story about how this story began. Lacey had an idea, I guess, right?
Yeah, sort of. We were hanging out in the kitchen one day. This was early on, and Lacey was kind of talking about how our routine has fallen apart, and we used to do, you know, school at this time of day, and, you know, the soccer practice here and piano there, and everything had kind of gone all topsy-turvy, and I made an offhanded comment, you know, well, normal's dead. Let's figure out what the new normal looks like. And our 9-year-old, you know, happened to be there and was sort of half listening. He said, normal's dead? Who's normal? And we thought it was kind of funny. And Lacey really took that idea and ran with it. She thought, oh, that'd be, you know, an interesting idea for maybe a story we could tell our kids. And so she wrote down a couple thoughts, and eventually that turned into, you know, a full draft of a picture book.
So a page in the book reads, and the reference here is to Normal, "The last time I saw him was 6 days ago. I remember because it was the same day that guy came to town, and that guy over there, his name is Chaos, and nothing has been the same since he showed up." I just love this. I don't think this is a kid's book. I really think it's an adult's book.
Yeah, it was very therapeutic writing it.
So the idea of writing a book is something that might come to people, but there's a little bit of work involved. How is the learning curve on working up a book and illustrations?
It was pretty intense at first because I was just totally taken up in this thought. And so, like, every second I'm, you know, trying to talk to Ace. And so he was really good about saying, we still have these kids. We still have my job. So let's set up a schedule. And 3 nights a week, we will just, you know, work until we need to go to bed and hammer out these ideas and get edits of the story and then start on illustration. And so we did that for the first couple of weeks. And then by the end, we were so excited and we wanted to get it out when it was still relevant that we ended up working on it every evening until it was finished.
To that point about it still being relevant, let me read another page. It says, "Chaos closed down the zoo, the library, and the playgrounds. Not much is the same. Many good things are gone. Things like friends and parties and even toilet paper." Ace, I think this book is going to be relevant forever because it is documenting the experience of this early pandemic.
Yeah, that was one of our thoughts initially. You know, before we decided, hey, maybe this would be useful to other people and let's put it up online, we thought, you know, we want to do this for two reasons. One is to maybe help our own kids process some of what's going on. And the other is to create a little bit of a legacy that they could look back on, you know, 20 years from now and sort of remember what this time was like. What were the serious and the silly things that were kind of occupying our minds at this time? And it's been, you know, it's been exciting now that the book is out to hear that so many others sort of have shared this experience with us. You know, we're in a socially distanced situation right now, and it sort of feels a lot of the time like we're going through these things alone. But what we heard when we put the book out there from, you know, folks on Facebook and other places where they found it was, hey, this is my experience too. And that's a very sort of comforting thought in a time like this when we're not seeing, you know, friends and family as often as we'd like to be.
And Ace, you keep referencing putting the book up, but it's free, although you are asking people to donate to a charity. But it's out there, posted online. People can download it, print it, and share it.
Yeah, exactly. We it's not necessarily, you know, a business for us or anything. It was just a project that helped fill some of our quarantine time, and we thought we'd share it. And so the back page of the book is an invitation to folks. You know, it says, if you like the story, please consider a donation to one of these nonprofits that's, you know, doing the recovery and relief work. So there's a list of suggested charities on our website that people can check out. We've also heard from folks, you know, as the book has spread to different countries, that there's been donations to sort of local nonprofits in areas where different readers live, where they're choosing their own, that, you know, holds some special meaning to them.
Lacey, what do your kids think about it?
I think right now they just think it's pretty cool that they are reading something that we wrote and their friends are, you know, oh, I read your mom's book or your dad's book. And I was talking about how that looks just like our park, or my library is doing the same thing. Or, you know, my niece will call and tell them that she read it over her Zoom. So I think right now they feel it's making them also feel more connected. And I think that's helpful because that's kind of what we're all looking for right now, is just feeling a little bit more connected to humanity.
Yeah, and I don't think I'm really doing any kind of a spoiler here to say that at the end of the book, chaos doesn't go away. Mm-hmm. Chaos stays in place. But when Normal comes back, this is so charming. The little girl in the story is holding a sign that says, "Welcome back, Normal. You've changed." And then she thinks, "But I've changed too." And I just really love that. I think that's so important to recognize.
Yeah, thank you so much. It was really important to us to not just have it wrapped up super nicely, because we don't know when it's going to end. So I felt like that would be kind of cheating the reader of this ongoing experience. And so we did want it to be like open-ended, if you will, that who knows when this is going to end, but we can still find ways to make ourselves happy and help others in our community and in our home and globally, if you can, but whatever the ways we can, but it's not necessarily going to go away. A quick fix is not in our future necessarily.
Well, that's Lacey and Ace Stryker. The book is Has Anyone Seen Normal? A Coronavirus Tale. And we'll post a link to the Facebook page where people can find it. It's pretty easy. Facebook.com/Has Anyone Seen Normal. And I thank you both so much. And I can't let you go without giving you a chance to do a little hello shout out to your kids from the radio.
That's awesome. Thank you. Hey, Stryker kids.
All right. Well, I wish you a lot of good new normal and some nice balance with the chaos there, okay?
Yeah. Thank you
thank
so
you
much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. The book is really great, really fun, really good conversation starter. So that will be at capradio.org/insight. Today, by the way, is the big day of giving. Nonprofits need help more than ever right now. So if you can, please support any of the groups that provide education or help, or in many cases, entertainment that matters in your life. And here at Cap Radio, you probably know we've begun our spring fund drive. It had been postponed during the early shutdown of COVID-19. We are member supported, and your contributions sustain every hour, every day, every person involved in our programming. So if news and music are important in your life, and we hope they are, please donate if you can. You can do it really easily at capradio.org. And that's Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruyak. Our producers who have been working in the trenches so wonderfully with me are Kyle McKinnon and Cynthia Lopez. We want to do a shout out to our digital team, Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, and Helga Salinas. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Our engineer is Antonio Munez. Insight's managing editor is Aram Sarkissian. I'm getting there before I have to cough. Joe Barr is CAF Radio's chief content officer. No worries, it's the cottonwood in the air, folks. We're going to be back at noon with live coverage of Governor Gavin Newsom's press conference. So stay well, stay informed, and thanks for joining us.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.